morning's scripture is taken from the book of 2 John, verses 7 through 11. That is 2 John, starting with verse 7 down through 11. And it reads as follows. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourself that we do not lose those things we work for, but that we may receive a full reward. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house nor greet him. For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds.
Appreciate the reading Percy just did. And in a moment, we're going to get into 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And you may want to turn in your Bible. I'll kind of go all around the first part of that chapter back and forth. So you might want to turn there. And you can also follow along with the PowerPoint. A couple of announcements I want to make before I actually get into the lesson. First of all, I neglected to put into the bulletin, and let me add, I should have recognized this and told Ed, but I didn't see it in time. But Midland also had a friend, remember, that passed away on Tuesday following surgery, so we want to give our condolences to her as well. And Tiffany, on a brighter note, Tiffany told me that her friend's brother, Victor Mendez, is actually doing some better. So we're thankful for that. He's in very serious condition, and please do continue to remember that family. He'll be in ICU about a month. Also, a couple of thanks that I want to give out. First of all, for you young kids or young children that are picking up those sheets, and without me having to encourage you to do so, that are picking those up and filling those out, and I noticed several of you with them, and that's great. So you guys keep up the good work on that. And follow along the sermons and so forth. I can tell you, and I know you older people really appreciate this as well, when a young person is coming up to you and talking about the sermon, it really does something for you. It's a great encouragement. So I'm thankful for that. And also, look up here on the board and notice that last Sunday, or this past week, our numbers were probably the closest, the least amount of discrepancy between Sunday morning, Sunday night especially, and Wednesday night than they've been in a long, long time. If you'll notice, we had 70 people last Sunday evening. That's great. And for those of you that turned out and were able to be here, I'm thankful to you for that. It's a great encouragement. I want to encourage you to please continue that. Make every effort you can to be at all the services. It really helps us all. Without any further delay, let's get into 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And this is going to be a chapter that I actually divide into two parts. Mainly, we've been taking a chapter at a time. But 2 Thessalonians 2 contains what is, for most people, two of the harder doctrinal passages in the New Testament. And so we're going to take them, we'll take them both. Now, the next lesson next month will overlap a little bit into chapter 3, and as you will see. But this morning we're going to look at the first part of it. Obviously, we're going to talk about the man of sin. Let me get right into that. Remember, we said last time that this book was probably written about AD 51, shortly, very shortly, after the first epistle had been written to them. And it was written for a specific reason. If you're looking here in chapter 2, it is written to address at least a doctrinal misconception. I really think more than one, but at least one. And that probably resulted from a combination of the influence of false teachers that were present in Thessalonica, their own misunderstanding of Paul's first epistle, and, as we'll note, also maybe what he had taught them in person while there. And as I said, are both. I think it's a combination of all. Notice what he says in verse 2. That you be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter as from us, or even as from us, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means. Let's go a little further with that. Here's what he's really saying. Notice when he says, neither by spirit. That generally indicates that a revelation has been given, probably referring to 1 Thessalonians, or a teacher that's bearing a revelation. Look down in verse 5 when he says, I told you these things. When he was there and he preached, he, in word, and again with the first epistle, had written to them. So neither by spirit, neither by word or letter. And finally, this is what he's really saying. He had a whole lot to say about Jesus' second coming. He will come. And that's a fact. But he says, on the basis of the fact that he will come, I don't want anyone to deceive you. Not even me, Paul is saying. I don't want anyone to deceive you about when he will come. Because it has quite obviously led to some doctrinal problems, and we're going to explore that really beginning next month. But it is a fact. And so we want to get into this because really Paul is saying, I don't want you to be deceived. There are two things that have got to happen. Two things must precede the final coming of Christ. Now, if you're looking at 2 Thessalonians 2, notice that he's really saying that in verse 3. Two things have got to happen, and here they are. There's got to be a falling away, and that man of sin has got to come. Now, it begs two immediate questions that have led to debate for 2,000 years, and if the world goes on, probably 2,000 more. And of course those are, what is the falling away you speak of, Paul, and who in the world is this man of sin that is to come? And there's all kinds of answers that are given. We're going to take a look at that, both, you know, some of the suggestions that have been given and what I really believe is the answer to those questions. But those two things have got to happen. So what is the falling away? Well, several suggestions have been offered through the centuries and still are. Some would say it's all historical. There was to be in Paul's day a great falling away. There has been. And so they speak of the great apostasy of the first century, though not everybody's agreed as to what that great apostasy was. Some would see it as different things and pick one. Some would see it as an amalgam of all those things that were going on in the first century and kind of throw all that together. We'll mention some of that in a moment. Some say it is a great persecution. It's either the great persecution of the past, maybe the first century, maybe the first three centuries, or the present. Some would look around and see, you know, the way Christians are being persecuted today, here, to a degree, and in different parts of the world. Others would see it as a great persecution that is yet to come, you know, kind of involved in all of that premillennial idea of the tribulation and all of that. But the main point of it being that it would overthrow the faith of Christians. So we're looking at a persecution that is so difficult, so hard, that many Christians lose their faith as a result. Again, some see it as a great apostasy of our day. We're going to mention some of that in a moment. Or a great apostasy that is yet to come. That either we see the seeds of it now, but not the fruition. Or we just don't have any idea. There will be something in the future that will be much greater than maybe we can even imagine. And it will result from either a doctrinal misconception or a philosophical one. And so some would get into that. And the philosophical influence, and I'll give you a couple of examples of what people are thinking when they suggest this. So you can see that there are several different suggestions that are offered for the great falling away that Paul speaks of. Now, so what falling away, I don't know why I had to punch that about a half dozen times, but let's just trust it's going to be okay. So to what falling away is Paul referring? Well, let me suggest to you, according to this passage, it is one that is already present in Paul's day, or past, and present, but one that's already at work. Why do I say that? Well, look at it. Paul speaks in the present and past tense. If you're looking at this passage, look down in verse 7 in particular. And it's pretty plain. The mystery of lawlessness, or the mystery of iniquity, depending on your translation, does already work. So whatever we're talking about here, in the sense of an apostasy, or a falling away, or a disobedience to God's law, etc., it's already going on. So I have a real problem with saying that this is all way in the future, And of course, you know, the whole premillennial, I'm not going to get into that, but the whole premillennial idea or other ideas about it. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Notice how he spoke in the past tense, really, in verses 10 and 12. He spoke of those or them that perish. And that's an ongoing thing, but something that has already occurred and continues to occur. In them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth. This was a choice already made by some people. Or again in verse 12, he speaks of a group of people who believed not the truth. So I think when you speak of a falling away here, again, as Paul said, let no man deceive you. Before Christ can come back, there must be a falling away. Well, it was a falling away that had at least, and don't misunderstand what I'm saying, I'm not saying that it had concluded, but I'm saying it has at least already begun. Now, it's got to be full. It's got to be the total amount. And I don't believe that that's been, that Paul is saying that has happened. But at least it's already begun. So it eliminates some of the ideas that people have of the great falling away. So what is it? Well, I believe that Paul speaks of the same falling away, the same apostasy that's spoken of throughout the New Testament. I'm going to touch on this two or three times in the lesson before I close. But it's a falling away that had begun and it continued as Paul was writing, and it would continue and grow to its fullness over the course of the New Testament age or over the church age. It's not any single denomination. I used to believe it was. I used to look in 2 Thessalonians 2 and vacillate back and forth, well, it's this denominational error or it's that apostasy. I don't believe it is any single denomination or denominational error. There are phrases that look like a single denominational error, but all the phrases won't fit it. Rather, I think it is, notice, brethren leaving the faith. And that's very important. We're not just talking about something from without, like a great philosophical trend that comes from without and sweeps through the church. And we're not talking about some denominational error that comes from without and sweeps through the church, carrying people away. We're talking about brethren leaving the faith. Notice, that's the way Paul speaks or discusses it here. It's what he's warning about. It's what he had begun to warn about in 1 Thessalonians chapters 2 and 3 especially. But now he's continuing to warn them. This is something coming from within. And you'll notice what I say here. It establishes a pattern for the church. Now, what do I mean by that? When I was writing this lesson, I was thinking about a Brother Tant from the 1800s, late 1800s. And the very early 1900s, and how he continued to warn brethren. He'd write articles, he preached sermons, and his phrase was, and he was known for it, "Brethren, we are drifting." And he noted trends going on among Christians. Historians of the church, what they have said is, you can start in the New Testament and you can see the same thing then that you can see in the 1800s, that you can see in the 1900s, and that you can see right now. And that is the basic pattern for the Lord's church is that people are always drifting. In other words, they're always leaving the faith. It happened from the first century all the way to now, and that's what's going on. So when Paul says, look at it again. When Paul says in verse 3, "Let no man deceive you by any means, that day shall not come," of course it's italicized, but that's what he's referring to. "That day won't come except there come a falling away first." Paul speaks of a whole thing, a whole falling away. It had begun then, it continues now. And we won't see the end of it, and we won't know the end of it until the trumpet blows, is the point. So it will be a continual falling away. At least that's what I believe that Paul is describing. Now, as we continue with this, our next question, and to many the biggest question, maybe the most interesting question, is who is the man of sin? Look at it again in verse 3, when he says, "And that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition." What do we know of the man of sin? Let's start. He is called the man of sin, verse 3. He's also called the son of perdition, verse 3. We know things of him. Verse 3, he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. Verse 3, he sits as God in his temple, notice. He shows himself, verse 4, that he is God. To many, that sounds exactly like this person or that person. Some see this, some see that. He is the wicked one, verse 8, or the lawless one. To some, that sounds like one individual in particular. And notice, though, in verse 8, whose coming is according to the working of Satan, verse 9. So the wicked one, the lawless one, verse 8, his coming is according to the working of Satan. Now that leads me to a couple of things. And let's look at it. We might ask the question, do many people fit this description? Or is Paul, in fact, referring to one great enemy? Many people look and say, well, he's certainly talking about one great enemy, the man of sin, the son of perdition, the wicked one, etc. And again, many people see this one or that one. But we might also suggest that it is one doing the bidding of Satan or is Satan himself. Well, I think you eliminate the idea of it being Satan himself. Why? We'll look back at verse 9. We're not speaking of Satan himself as much as we're talking about those that do the bidding of Satan or someone who does the bidding of Satan. So we're still left with our question. We can eliminate, I think, that we're talking about Satan, even though some people believe, no, we're talking about Satan here. He is the man of sin. He is the son of perdition. And they would go back to Isaiah and Ezekiel and add some phrases to really get to that. But I think we can eliminate that. But it's one doing the bidding of Satan. Who is it? Well, your next question is then to ask this question, and I guess I already said that. It's not Satan as one doing his work. But you're left with this question. Is it one individual? Or is it more than one? Well, let's stay with the idea of one individual. Here's what people say. Premillennialists see the Antichrist. You never see the word Antichrist here, but they say this is the Antichrist. And they would add this to some statements made by John in 1st and 2nd John. They would add this to some statements made in the book of Revelation, several statements made back in Daniel. Those of you that are in my Daniel class, especially those ideas of Daniel 7 and that little horn, and again Daniel 11 in those prophecies, and a number of other passages, the Antichrist, the Pope, some people see. And they would point especially to verse 4. The one who sits in the temple of God. One who shows himself to be God. The idea of the Pope speaking ex cathedra. The idea of the Pope being the vicar of Christ or in the place of Christ on earth. Some people would see the papacy. And really not one individual Pope, but the papacy itself. Others would see the Roman Emperor and say Paul was speaking of the same thing John really takes the whole book of Revelation to talk about. And interpret that as not just one Roman emperor, but a number of them, maybe 10 to 12 of them in particular, culminating in Decius and Diocletian in the late 200s and early 300s. Others would say it's the beast of Revelation. Whether or not that's the emperor, it's the beast, and it's the mark of the beast. And 666, that's the great persecution that leads to a great apostasy. People say, after all, if you can't eat, a lot of people are going to leave the faith to be able to buy food so they can eat or their families can eat. Others would see it as some modern leader. And they would say it might be a military leader. Some great leader in the vein of an Alexander the Great or a Hitler, but only successful. Sets out to conquer the whole world and does it. And, I mean, let's admit it. In this day and time, some of the things that are at a military genius, maniacal individual with the nuclear weapons and so forth, the world economy and the way it's all tied together, it would be much easier today than it has ever been. Not harder, easier. Some say a great political leader, whether it is somebody that's able to, first of all, unite all the Arabs, and I've heard that proposed, and because of that opposition, sweep through the world in a political sense, not just religiously, but politically, or some great spiritual leader that somehow captures the hearts and conscience and minds of most of the people on earth. And it's a one great world religion that's many times spoken of as being tied in with a one great world economy and a one great world political system and on it goes. You have to understand, and we all do, that in some of these countries, the political leader is very much also the spiritual leader. What if that went beyond just a country or coalition of countries and in fact became a world? So you can see where people go with this. I go on and on about that, but I'm not going to take your time. It's just that a number of suggestions are offered for this man of sin. We've not seen him yet, perhaps, but we can see how he, some would say we have, but most people would say we've not seen him yet, but we see how it could be. Now, on the other hand, it might also be an entity that's being talked about. Now, I want you to listen closely to what I'm going to say here. Because what Paul may be talking about is an embodiment, picturing it as one person, but the embodiment of a whole entity. In other words, you might say, well, that sounds too far-fetched. Well, not really. Look back at the reading from 2 John and listen to what is said in verse 7. Many deceivers, plural, have entered into the world. Many deceivers. Then he says, this, or literally, this one is a deceiver and an antichrist. So what he speaks of is a group that becomes pictured as one person. In other words, many deceivers are one antichrist. Many deceivers are one deceiver. That's not so far-fetched. We do that in our language too. If I were to ask you the question, who is Uncle Sam? Uncle Sam wants you. Who is Uncle Sam? Well, Uncle Sam is America. He is our government. He is our people. He is our army. Uncle Sam is an individual that we picture, but he stands for a whole large group of people. So maybe it's not as far-fetched to say it's not one literal man, it's an entity. Now let's look at that and what some suggest. You start with Satan, who I believe is the supreme antichrist, the one who opposes Christ. And you ask the question, what is at Satan's disposal? Well, denominational errors, both those that we see in the first century and those that continue today. What do we see in the first century? We see Gnosticism, and we won't get into that. We've talked about it in here. Others of you have looked at that a lot more extensively. We see Judaism, the idea of adding the Old Testament to the New, and we still see that today, don't we? We see Catholicism and great denominations like that that have emerged. We see Protestantism, let's not just pick on Catholicism, because equally opposing the truth are Protestants. We see liberalism, and when I say liberalism here, I'm not talking about, you know, this group or that. I'm talking about all liberal thinking, and especially religious liberalism. I believe in, you know, whatever, the inspiration of the Bible, which means there's some good thoughts in it. I believe in Jesus, but he wasn't God. I don't believe in the resurrection, the virgin birth, etc. That kind of liberalism. Our great governmental opposition. Satan has that. The Bible shows us that Satan can work in the affairs of men and can be behind the power and authority of people. So we see the Roman Empire opposing Christians. We see the Holy Roman Empire and the Spanish Inquisition and all of that kind of thing. We see Hitler, for example, and that great government. We see communism, some of you in the not-too-distant past. We see today the threat that many people feel of a Muslim coalition. And we could go on and on with that. We see great philosophical trends that oppose the church. Evolution might not be as strong as it was 100 years ago, but 100 years ago, people were certain it was going to undermine the faith of everybody. So we see trends like that. The Eastern mysticism, maybe of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that continues today, but in those three decades was so popular. So many people leaving their belief in Jesus and buying into that. Today we see the humanism and the great philosophical trend that that is among people, and we could go on. Some people say it's the great technological advancements that are scary. The internet is a magnificent, almost miraculous thing to people. But that's the problem. It is so great. Things like that, technological advancements like that, scare people of faith because it is that great power being utilized. And if you're not aware of that, Go on the internet and look at some of the discussions. Just punch in the Bible. Punch in Jesus. And notice where that leads you. Every day, massive discussions going on where people are undermining the faith of gullible people who buy into all of that. People see that kind of thing. Space travel. You know, and you know, you see what I put up here, alien contact. You might say, oh, come on, Michael, you're ridiculous. You know, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying the belief in it. Turn on the television and listen to the belief about aliens. What we would have considered Saturday morning cartoon fodder, those of you that are old enough to remember the cartoons of the 70s and even 80s, are now being discussed on the History Channel, the National Geographic Channel, the Science and Nature channels as fact. Okay. People see that. And they begin to speculate if space travel reaches that point and if our contact reaches that point and we do contact all those aliens of Star Wars and Star Trek and all those aliens we believe we're sure by faith exist out there. What will that do to the faith of you people that think, here we are on this little planet, this little ball made by this antiquated God? It's those kinds of things. It's that kind of advancement that scares people, and that kind of advancement that Satan has at his disposal. And that's the point. So as we begin to talk about the man of sin, it's an entity, I believe. It's everything at Satan's disposal. Paul speaks of Satan's presence in the church. And obviously, if you notice in chapter 2, he's not talking about outside the church. He speaks of within. He speaks of Satan's presence in the church. And it's destroying the faith of Christians. Satan is. He's deceiving them by various means. All those we just had up on that list and more. He's utilizing everything at his disposal to oppose Christ. And obviously, he's very successful. He's blinded the minds of those who would believe the glorious light of the gospel in 2 Corinthians 4. Satan is doing that. Notice some of the things the Bible says and warns. I won't go spend much time on these passages, but let's just put up a scattering of passages to note it. Jesus told a parable in Matthew 13. He said, the enemy that we know to be Satan, the enemy sows tares, weeds that look like wheat, in the field that grow together with the wheat in the kingdom, not outside, in the kingdom until the harvest. Notice Acts chapter 20 when Paul warned the elders from Ephesus in verses 28 to 30. He said, from among yourselves men will arise speaking perverse things and they will draw away disciples after them. Notice Paul was speaking in the church that will happen. In Colossians 2, in verses 8, and I wish we had time to spend a lot of time on this whole section. But notice, beware lest anyone spoil you, rob you, steal you away is the idea, like loot, through philosophy and empty deceit. And there's a very interesting phrase there, and I won't get off on a linguist tangent here. But when he says, according to human tradition, and lastly, according to the elements of the world. Many people are looking at this phrase now, or that phrase in Colossians 2, and saying, you know, we may be seeing the fullest degree of that phrase Paul used than we've ever seen, or that God used, really. Because as you dig into that, and when he goes on to talk about, down in verse 18, the false humility and I put up here proud theories. The idea is theories and thoughts about the very creation of the world. The foundation of the world, the elements, the rudiments of the world. Are we not seeing that? I mean, really, everywhere you turn, school, on the job, common language, people talking about it, books, movies, television shows, songs, everything else are filled with these proud theories and proud thoughts that are anti-God. And people are just inundated with that. You almost feel like a fool to hold on. Some people do. To hold on to this outdated notion of God made us in His image. You're made to feel that way. And you're warned by God 2,000 years ago to recognize it for what it is. Notice 1 Timothy 4. Some will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, notice, coming from Satan. They'll forbid to marry. They'll tell you you have to abstain from certain foods, and on it goes. Notice 2 Peter 2. There will be false teachers among you, Peter said. And they'll bring in ruinous heresies, denying the Lord, and many will follow their ruinous ways, things that just destroy you. You'll listen. You'll buy into it. You'll believe it. Even though you're a Christian, even though you know the truth, you'll find yourself doing the things that the world does and being ruined by it. Satan has that. 1 John 2, verse 19, speaks of many antichrists. And notice as Paul or as John describes them, those who went out from us, for if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But now they went out, and that's where they are. Notice Revelation 2. Where Jesus says to the church there in Revelation 2, I know where Satan's throne is. And when you hear that, you think, well, okay, great. Where is it? In Tartarus? In Hades? In hell? No, I know where Satan's throne is. Antipas was killed among you where Satan dwells. Where is that? In the Lord's church. We see Jesus himself warning us. Satan is right here. Jesus is here. But so is Satan. He has false doctrines. He teaches people to practice immorality. They buy in and do it. I want you to close with me today reading Revelation 13. And I want you to hear this. The man of sin, Satan, has at his disposal the ability to cause great opposition to the Lord's people. Listen to the language of Revelation 13. Start with me in verse 1. I stood upon the sand of the sea, that many believe, and I do as well, represents all of humanity. I saw this beast rise up out of the sea, and he had 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns were 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet that of a bear, his mouth like that of a lion, and the dragon that he just told you in chapter 12 is Satan. The dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and his great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it were wounded to death. In other words, it'd be like a Christian watching a great world power, and it looks like they're defeated, but they're not. And they come storming back. And his deadly wound, or his mortal wound, was healed. And all the world was amazed. They just wondered after the beast. Can anything be that great, that magnificent? And they worshipped, notice, the dragon, Satan, who gave power to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? And it's almost as if a Christian is looking at the church as it struggles, and then looking at this great power that Satan has created, and says, who is like the beast? And there was given him, verse 5, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Oh, so there is a limit to it. Absolutely. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme God's name and his tabernacle. And that's you. And them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Listen to that. Faith being destroyed. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, verse 8, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world. If any man has an ear, let him hear. But never forget what this said in this passage. It sounds like utter defeat for God's people. 42 months. Those that stay with God see the victory. Nothing that ever comes in this world, no matter how powerful, ever overthrows completely the faith of all of God's people. And the church always comes back. And it always will. If you're here this morning and you believe in that power, the power of Jesus, the Son of God, and you would confess that He is indeed the Son of God, the Lord of all the earth. If you would repent and be baptized, your sins will be forgiven, and you will be His child. Maybe you're here this morning and you've allowed something to lead you away from God. maybe even to undermine your faith. But you know that God is still God, in total control. And you want to put your faith and place your faith and confess your faith in Him yet again. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?